Americans in Chicago started off in Indiana.
Nick, we only have 30 seconds, but we're talking about a moment now where the NRA, the National Rifle Association, is completely hobbled. You have the mass American population, including NRA members, overwhelmingly for more gun control, overwhelmingly. The only people who are stopping the legislation are the Republican senators in the U.S. Congress, the Republican senators. How is this possible at this moment, and how do you see getting around this? 20 seconds.
Well, you know, the answer always for us in the gun violence prevention movement is fight, fight, fight. Join the fight. Text checks to 64433. Join that fight, because there is overwhelming support for sensible, sensible gun policies. And the GOP senators have lost all of their excuses for not standing with us and passing common sense gun reform.
Nick Cipollino, we want to thank you for being with us, Managing Director for Law and Policy at Every Town for Gun Safety. And that does it for our show, Democracy Now! Produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Berkley, Nick Usner, Nermeen Sheikh, Maria Terracena, Carla Wills, Tammy Warren, Afterina Nadouras, I'm Malkoff, Tamaria Studio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Masood, Adriana Contreras, our General Manager, Julie Crosby, Becca Staley, our Director. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe. Wear a mask.
You are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Development and Events Committee meets on the fourth Monday of the month at 4:30 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
It's an Earth Day reggae celebration.
Tune in to Shocks of Sheba Thursday, April 22nd at noon as we showcase reggae songs with Earth Day themes.
Mother Nature is angry. She's getting upset. If she ever get mad, trust me, mankind have a threat. Mother Nature is angry.
There will be special Earth Day programming all day on April 22nd here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on this spring membership drive special of the KBOO Evening News. Former police officer Derek Chauvin is found guilty on all charges in the murder of George Floyd. Portland police release dispatch audio recordings of the fatal shooting of Robert Delgado at Lentz Park. And Governor Kate Brown announces new COVID-19 risk levels for counties in Oregon. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 20th, 2021. KBOO is currently in our membership drive, and we'd like to urge you to become a member by going online to kboo.fm/give. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Former police officer Derek Chauvin was found guilty of all charges on Tuesday in the murder of George Floyd. The jury reached a guilty verdict after deliberating for 10 hours over 2 days. The decision follows an emotional trial that lasted 3 weeks. Chauvin was found guilty of second-degree murder, third-degree murder, and second-degree manslaughter for killing Floyd in May of last year. During closing arguments, prosecutors sought to focus jurors' attention on the almost 10 minutes Chauvin knelt on Floyd's neck while he was handcuffed and lying on the ground. Here's Hennepin County Judge Peter Cahill announcing the jury's verdict.
We, the jury, in the above-entitled matter as to count one, unintentional second-degree murder while committing a felony, find the defendant guilty. Same caption, verdict count two. We, the jury, in the above-entitled matter as to count two, third-degree murder perpetrating an eminently dangerous act, find the defendant guilty. Same caption, verdict count three. We, the jury, in the above-entitled matter as to count three, second-degree manslaughter, culpable negligence, creating an unreasonable risk, find the defendant guilty. This verdict agreed to this 20th day of April 2021 at 1:45 p.m.
Chauvin faces up to 40 years in prison based on his convictions, but he is likely to receive a less severe sentence as a first-time offender. The presumptive sentence for second-degree murder is 12 and a half years, according to Minnesota's sentencing guidelines, although prosecutors have asked for a higher sentence. The verdict is a milestone moment for a legal system that rarely holds police officers accountable, especially when the victims are Black. Cheers erupted outside the courtroom in Minneapolis, where the verdict was read, as well as at George Floyd Square, the memorial to where Floyd was killed. Chauvin's bail was revoked, and he was placed in handcuffs in the courtroom and remanded into custody after the guilty verdict was read. A direct action march took place Monday night in Northeast Portland. The demonstration was on behalf of George Floyd as the jury in the Derek Chauvin murder trial began deliberations. At around 9:30 p.m., a group of about 80 people began marching from Woodland Park to the North Precinct. Police warned marchers to not engage in criminal acts or they would be subject to arrest, force, and munitions. Portland police declared the event an unlawful assembly at around 9:50 p.m. and ordered the crowd to disperse. Two people were arrested during the demonstration. Portland City Commissioner Joanne Hardesty urged people to stop setting fires during protests, in part because of the red flag warning from the recent hot and dry weather. Hardesty said, quote, "I understand the rage in our community right now. I know the feeling of trying as hard as you can to bring change to an archaic institution that seems intent on shutting out and discrediting your voice. However, as the Portland Fire and Rescue Commissioner, I am pleading with our community to stop lighting fires, whether it's at a protest or a backyard fire pit. We should all be horrified that climate change is causing such dry conditions that there is a Multnomah County burn ban in mid-April. These conditions make fires of any kind especially dangerous right now." The Portland Police Bureau has released dispatch audio recordings detailing the minutes leading up to the fatal shooting of 46-year-old Robert Delgado at Lentz Park on April 16th. PPB has also released photos of a replica handgun they allege Delgado was carrying at the time of his death. The recordings do not offer detailed descriptions of the interaction between Delgado and the officers in the moments before the shooting. 4 minutes after law enforcement arrived at the park, Officer Zachary DeLong shot and killed Delgado. According to the police bureau, DeLong was 90 feet away from Delgado when he was shot. Bystander video taken of the incident shows officers standing what looks more to be about 60 feet away from Delgado when DeLong shot him. PPB noted that two other officers fired at Delgado during the incident, but used so-called less lethal impact munitions. DeLong is on paid administrative leave pending PPB's investigation into the shooting. Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt said the investigation will be methodical and unrushed. Schmidt wrote in a statement Saturday, quote, "It is expected that this case will be presented to a grand jury to determine whether the use of deadly force was a legal act of self-defense and or self-defense of others," unquote. Interviews with witnesses, officers, and others at the scene, along with the grand jury transcript, will be made public after the ruling is delivered. With the Derek Chauvin trial nearing an end, along with protests over the police shooting of Dante Wright, the way authorities respond to demonstrators is getting renewed focus, including concerns from Minnesota's medical community. Mike Moen has more on the story with the Public News Service.
State and local law enforcement response to police protests in Minnesota is drawing new scrutiny with the Daunte Wright shooting and the Derek Chauvin trial. Over the weekend, more than 100 medical professionals held a rally in Brooklyn Center a week after Wright, who was black, was fatally shot by a police officer. The incident set off several nights of protests where authorities clashed with demonstrators, with officers deploying tear gas and non-lethal projectiles. Erica Kasky, a medical student at the University of Minnesota, is among those decrying the use of these tactics.
We want people in Minnesota to be able to express their voice and their concerns in a safe way. Unfortunately, we worry if the use of these weapons continues, based on our findings, that protesters might become patients.
The New England Journal of Medicine recently published Kasky's research on local ER visits stemming from last year's protests after George Floyd's murder. She says dozens required immediate care, including for injuries from rubber bullets. Some 40% were head, face, and neck injuries, which Kasky says goes against UN guidelines. Some in law enforcement say the methods are required to protect residents and property when protests escalate. But community activists argue that law enforcement often incites tension with its militarized look following a controversial incident. As for tear gas, its use in last week's protests heightened concerns because of the impact on nearby residents who weren't part of the demonstration. Kasky says that came up in her research of last year's events as well.
And this exacerbated conditions like COPD and asthma that required an emergency room visit.
And as closing arguments begin today in the Chauvin trial, activists say they have similar fears, noting a beefed-up National Guard presence in the metro area. Law enforcement also has been criticized for its treatment of journalists in recent protests, despite reporters clearly displaying their credentials. The outcry prompted an apology from Governor Tim Walz. And cities like Brooklyn Center have adopted resolutions banning certain police tactics during protests. There's a similar proposal in the legislature. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
The Oregon Health Authority reported 473 new cases of COVID-19 on Monday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 175,592. Oregon health officials reported no new deaths, meaning the state's death toll remains at 2,460 people. There are currently 243 people hospitalized statewide, including 57 patients in intensive care units. So far, more than 2.6 million doses of a COVID-19 vaccine have been administered across Oregon, and 25% of the state's population has been fully vaccinated. Governor Kate Brown announced on Tuesday that Washington County, along with 9 other counties, will move up to the higher-risk COVID-19 category on Friday. That means there will be 23 counties in the higher-risk level, 3 at moderate risk, and 10 at lower risk. These risk levels will remain in effect until May 6th. Nationally, the U.S. has reported more than 31.7 million cases of COVID-19. At least 567,000 people have died across the country. Over the past week, there has been an average of about 67,000 new cases reported per day, an increase of 4% from the average 2 weeks earlier. All adults in every state are now eligible for a COVID-19 vaccine. More than 3 million doses are being administered each day. So far, more than 40% of the population has received at least one dose of a COVID-19 vaccine, with 26% fully vaccinated. Globally, the coronavirus pandemic has sickened more than 141.7 million people. At least 3 million people have died across the world. The Oregon House of Representatives has been forced to delay floor sessions until next week following a possible COVID-19 exposure at the Capitol building. According to the Oregon legislature, a person who was at the Capitol on Thursday, April 15th, tested positive for COVID-19 and may have made contact with people on the floor of the House. Human resources officials have been notifying everyone thought to have had close contact with the infected person. This is the third time this year that the House has had to shut down daily sessions due to a possible COVID-19 exposure. The cancellation means 10 police accountability and reform bills scheduled to receive a vote Tuesday will be delayed, along with other bills on the agenda. In the meantime, committee work will continue as planned remotely. Floor sessions are slated to resume in person on Monday, April 26th. an Oregon state lawmaker, is accusing a fellow representative of harassment and pressure to engage in a quid pro quo arrangement. Republican State Representative Vicky Breese Iverson of Prineville is accusing State Representative Brad Witt, a Democrat from Clatsacani, of sexual harassment and says he used text messages to offer a quid pro quo arrangement. The allegations were outlined in a letter by Breese Iverson to Oregon House Speaker Tina Kotek. Breese Iverson has asked that Kotek remove Witt from the three legislative committees they both serve on. The contents of the text messages Breese Iverson referred to remain unclear, but the letter adds new details to allegations that emerged against Witt last week. On Friday, the House Conduct Committee investigated a formal complaint against Witt, concluding that recommending Witt's removal as committee chair was not warranted. The committee ultimately issued a no-contact order between Witt and Breese Iverson as an interim safety measure. Witt has also volunteered to step down temporarily as committee chair. Republicans have since said that more action is needed. The investigation is expected to conclude by the end of April. The matter would then go before the House Conduct Committee to consider whether Witt violated legislative rules and whether there should be consequences. You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Grow Portland. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear skies with a low of 49 degrees. Tomorrow will be sunny with a high of 78 degrees. Today in history, in 1902, Marie and Pierre Curie successfully isolate radium in their laboratory in Paris, France. Marie Curie went on to become the first woman to win a Nobel Prize, along with her husband, in 1904. She also later became the first person to win a second Nobel Prize. The quote of the day is from author and journalist Kenneth Ajiba, who said, quote, "We all have a duty to continue the fight when the dust settles. What we crave more than ever is societal reform, which will seep into how police officers confront personal biases." Last week, the North Dakota Senate gave final legislative approval to a controversial transgender sports bill. The measure now heads to the desk of Governor Doug Burgum, who faces calls to veto the plan. The bill saw heavy opposition from a wide range of groups who cite multiple ways it could harm the state. Mike Moen has more on the story with the Public News Service.
North Dakota's governor faces growing calls to reject legislation that would bar transgender student athletes from playing on sports teams that don't align with their birth gender. The controversial measure, which would affect K-12 students, saw heavy opposition before clearing its final legislative hurdle last week. LGBTQ advocates call it discriminatory and say it creates more opportunities for trans students to be bullied and harassed. Amy Jacobson of the group Prairie Action says there's a host of other concerns that were outlined during public testimony.
One of the loudest groups that the legislature heard from was really business and tourism.
Others calling for a veto say the law would lead to costly litigation. Supporters of bills like this say it's about fairness in girls' sports and preventing boys from playing them. Governor Burgum's office did not respond to a question about whether he would veto or not. The measure is similar to proposals that surfaced in other states this year, including South Dakota. Opponents like Jacobson argue all these measures do is codify discrimination, while noting supporters had difficulty producing evidence of this being an issue in school sports. She says the bill was made worse by adding a provision for a study, even as the law would take effect.
That doesn't really make much sense. We shouldn't put youth in danger to try to figure out how our policy impacts them.
The North Dakota High School Activities Association already has a policy that deals with this issue, and bill opponents say it works just fine. If the governor were to veto the bill, political observers say an override might be harder in the Senate, with last week's approval vote being relatively close. Mike Moen, Public News Service.
The jury deliberates before coming to a guilty verdict in the murder trial of Derek Chauvin. The White House agrees to raise the cap on refugees, and President Joe Biden and Vice President Kamala Harris try to win over supporters for their infrastructure plan. With more on the story, it's Laura Rosbrow-Tellum with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
You can believe your eyes. It's what you felt in your gut. It's what you now know in your heart. This wasn't policing. This was murder. The defendant is guilty of all three counts, and there's no excuse.
Steve Schleicher, an attorney for the prosecution of former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin, gave closing arguments Monday, describing George Floyd's last moments in detail. He argued Chauvin's continued use of force against Floyd for 9 minutes and 29 seconds was excessive and unjustifiable. Chauvin is charged with second-degree murder, second-degree manslaughter, and third-degree murder for Floyd's death, which sparked worldwide protests over racial justice last summer. Chauvin's defense attorney, Eric Nelson, made his closing argument by explaining Chauvin, quote, does not have to prove his innocence. Instead, he said the jury needs to put themselves in the shoes of an officer in the same situation. Nelson emphasized before officers put him on the ground, Floyd, while handcuffed, resisted going into the back of a police car, saying he was claustrophobic.
It shows that human beings make decisions in highly stressful situations that they believe to be right in the very moment it is occurring.
While such an argument is often used to defend police actions, it is usually employed to justify quick, often split-second decisions, rather than more controlled situations over a longer period of time. The 12 jurors in the trial are now in deliberations. Attorney General Merrick B. Garland commemorated the 26th anniversary of the Oklahoma City bombing Monday, promising to combat domestic extremism.
Department of Justice is pouring its resources into stopping domestic violent extremists before they can attack, and prosecuting those who do, and battling the spread of the kind of hate that leads to tragedies like the one we mark today.
So far, the Justice Department has arrested more than 400 defendants in their investigation of the January 6th attack on the Capitol. The White House is getting flack from several Democrats for announcing it would not increase the number of refugees allowed into the country, keeping former President Donald Trump's cap of 15,000. White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki said Monday President Joe Biden plans to raise the limit by May 15th. Biden met with a bipartisan group of congresspeople Monday to discuss potential changes to his $2 trillion infrastructure plan.
I am prepared to compromise. I asked senators and congressmen who had either been governors or mayors because they know what it's like to make things work.
Meanwhile, Vice President Kamala Harris promoted the infrastructure plan in North Carolina.
Good jobs are what the president and I will create with the American Jobs Plan.
Some see the administration shifting their message to focus on the quality of the plan's jobs rather than the potential number, which was initially exaggerated. For Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Laura Rosbrow-Tellum. Thanks for listening.
Montana tribes finalize a missing persons response plan. The Supreme Court will hear a Tribal CARES Act funding dispute, and First Lady Jill Biden plans a visit to the Navajo Nation. With those stories and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The Confederated Salish and Kootenai tribes in northwest Montana have finalized their plan to improve coordination and agency response when Indigenous people go missing in the Flathead area. Yellowstone Public Radio's Caitlin Nicholas reports it's part of a National Department of Justice project that will be used as a model for other tribes seeking to make their own community-specific plans.
CSKT has been developing their tribal community response plan since December 2020. The plan focuses on identifying and updating policies of law enforcement, victim services, media communication, and a log of community resources to streamline what happens when someone goes missing. Ellie Bundy, a CSKT council member and the presiding officer of the Montana Missing Indigenous Persons Task Force, announced the plan's completion in a task force meeting Wednesday. She says one major accomplishment is the plan brings all 10 law enforcement agencies working with CSKT into alignment.
Our law enforcement agencies establish a common missing Indigenous persons response policy, which is huge.
The plan also establishes a joint file system where law enforcement agencies can view and share information on cases, as well as a media lead for all CSKT missing persons communication. Bundy urged task force members to remember the people behind the missing persons statistics and policies. She spoke about the life of Jermaine Charlot, a CSKT woman who's been missing since 2018. She also told stories of other missing and murdered Indigenous people, including Ashley Loring Heavyrunner, a Blackfeet woman who's been missing since June 2017, and Selena Not Afraid, a Crow teenager who was found dead in January 2020.
And so the numbers I want you to consider today, 16, 18, 20, 21, 22, 23, the ages of these young ladies when they went missing. Think of someone in your family who may be that age.
Bundy says a particularly important part of developing the response plan was inviting family members of victims to discuss how procedures could be made more efficient based on their experiences. In Montana, for National Native News, I'm Caitlin Nicholas.
On Monday, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral arguments in a case to decide if Alaska Native corporations will receive federal coronavirus relief funds set aside for tribes in the CARES Act. More than a dozen tribes, including six in Alaska, sued the Treasury Department, saying the funding is for federally recognized tribal governments and not for for-profit Alaska Native corporations. ANCs argue language in the CARES Act includes them, as they serve Alaska Native people. The question before the court is whether Alaska Native regional and village corporations are Indian tribes for purposes of the CARES Act. Last year, Congress directed the Treasury Department to disperse $8 billion of relief aid to tribes. At stake now is more than $500 million held back for ANCs. Many people are closely watching the case for potential impacts on tribes. A decision in the case could be made in the summer. First Lady of the United States, Jill Biden, is planning a visit to the Navajo Nation this week. Her office announced the visit to the Southwest. Navajo leaders told Arizona television station CBS 5 they look forward to the First Lady's visit and would like to address health care and education. Dr. Biden is familiar with the Navajo Nation and has met with Navajo people in the past, but this will be her first visit as First Lady. The Cherokee Nation on Monday unveiled two eco-friendly buses for transportation to health centers and school. The Oklahoma tribe says the buses are the first of their kind in the state. The electric transit buses are part of an effort to reduce the Cherokee Nation's carbon footprint. They replace some diesel-powered vehicles. The tribe received a federal grant in 2018 for the transit project. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Increasingly extreme fires, the result of climate change, could blunt opportunities for some outdoor marijuana growers. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. As more states pass laws permitting marijuana use, the legal barriers to growing cannabis are crumbling. But wildfires pose risks to many outdoor growers in California and the Pacific Northwest. Jonathan Vaught is CEO of Front Range Biosciences, a Colorado-based biotech company that breeds hemp and provides nursery expertise to cannabis growers. He says wildfire smoke can temporarily block out sunlight. That can shorten the time the plant spends growing branches and leaves.
It can stunt the growth. It can even, with a photosensitive plant like cannabis, cause it to go into early flowering.
That can reduce the overall yield. Soot and ash can also settle onto leaves and soil. Some of it can be cleaned off, but much is still unknown about how wildfire smoke can affect the plants in the longer term. Vaught says smoke could taint the flavor, or even worse, if buildings or structures that contain lead or fire retardants burn.
Then you can actually end up with even much more toxic types of compounds that can contaminate your crop.
As the climate changes, wildfires are getting more extreme. So while growers may see new opportunities as cannabis laws change, they may also face growing risks. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to a spring membership drive edition of the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, April 20th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto.
Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Antonia Gonzalez, Mike Moen, Laura Rosbrow-Tellum, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. Then at 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. KBOO's currently in our spring membership drive. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth interview with Grow Portland.
KBOO News In-Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Today on KBOO News In-Depth, I'm speaking with John Burt, the executive director of the nonprofit organization Farmers Ending Hunger. Farmers Ending Hunger is an organization that works toward eliminating hunger in Oregon by connecting farmers, processors, and food banks. The pandemic has increased the need for food bank support as millions have lost work or income because of COVID-related closures. At least a quarter of those households who receive emergency food supplies supported by Farmers Ending Hunger have at least one family member employed.
So Farmers Ending Hunger started in 2004 to try to address the hunger problem in Oregon. So let's start out by talking through some of that history.
You bet. Some very smart people and very people with a great, you know, hearts on their sleeves who formed Farmers Ending Hunger really started with our president and really founding board member Fred Ziari. He's an agricultural irrigation and engineering consultant. Office mainly based over in Hermiston, Oregon, and he had actually was in Portland and went to a meeting hosted by Oregon Food Bank, and that was in 2004 or 2005. At that point, Oregon was number one in the nation in food insecurity, and it was making front page news. And so Fred goes to the meeting and he hears about all this, and he's a smart guy, and he says, you know, and he is a really smart guy. He says, I'm pretty smart. I don't know anything about this. I didn't know this. And worse, I'm in agriculture, and I still didn't know about it. So his thinking, the way Fred thinks, is who better to feed hungry people than farmers? And so he decided he was going to go about contacting his farmer friends over in that part of the country, Hermiston, Boardman, Pendleton, all that area, the lower Columbia Basin, and they all said yes. It was a great idea. What took you so long? So he also talked to some other key people that he knew, and they formed Farmers Ending Hunger. They called it. Took them a long time. They, well, several meetings, he said, and they figured out the name, Farmers Ending Hunger, and created a nonprofit, and then started talking to people. And I showed up a little bit later.
So where is the organization today? What does Farmers Ending Hunger's work look like in 2021?
Well, last year was an interesting year. Talk about 2020, but we still solicit donations from farmers, primarily. That's what we're about, to donate food crops, wheat, which we have then made into baking mix. We get cattle, which we have processed into hamburger. We get large quantities of fresh potatoes, fresh onions, and we also get a pretty sizable amount of fresh sweet cherries each year and other fruit and vegetables that we can work to receive. And all of this is then delivered to or picked up by Oregon Food Bank. So that the Oregon Food Bank and the Oregon Food Bank Network is our primary distribution model. It's it. And so we rely on them for the handling and distribution throughout their statewide network of all the regional food banks and pantries throughout the state. And so we've been doing this for 14 years now, and millions of pounds of high-quality food has made its way to Oregon Food Bank over these years, and we still think the model works. And so we're trying to keep up, and we're always looking for new growers that are willing to donate and ways to get it to the food bank. The other part of our model is to get it to Oregon Food Bank in a form that doesn't require any more processing or handling, and that'll go into a food box. So they have volunteers. I say handling, I mean some of this stuff we send to them, and this was part of the problem last year, is we send semi-loads of, say, potatoes or onions, and they may be bulk, or they totally in the truck, or they could be in 1,000-pound super sacks or totes. So it requires volunteers to repackage into, say, you know, like 5-pound bags or 10-pound bags of potatoes and onions that can then go in a food box. And last year, with COVID, there was a period of time of about 2 or 3 months where Oregon Food Bank wasn't having enough volunteers in because of the restrictions to handle the product. So we had to stop delivering for a little while there. So, but they eventually figured out a way to do it by spacing and getting things going. And a couple of our donors shifted from large totes to 50-pound bags, let's say, that can then be handled by individuals. And so we made it work around it as best we could. But that's our model, and we do anywhere from 3 to 4 million pounds of products a year.
Are there other ways that the pandemic has changed how your organization works?
Yeah, like everybody else, we had to cancel a lot of events that we would have gone to that were potential fundraisers. So fundraising was a bit of an issue. You know, we ended up the year okay. We got a couple of nice donations from supporters, but we had an event that was scheduled over in Pendleton. It was going to be one of these Dancing with the Stars events, and a good fundraiser. It's a big event over there, and we're well established there. Well, that didn't happen, and we were going to have another event in Portland, the Koshan. It's a pork national. It's a national event was going to be held in Portland, and we were going to be the featured nonprofit. Well, that didn't happen. And then our other big one is we're tied in with the Pendleton Roundup and Happy Canyon over there. And we have a day. We have our Farmers Ending Hunger Day during the Roundup in Happy Canyon. And, of course, the Roundup didn't happen either. So that was a little disruptive. Also, some of our donor growers, farmers, because of the restrictions, the amount that they could harvest and get to us was reduced. We work with a cherry grower over in the Dalles, and they had to limit the number of pickers that they could have in the orchard at any one time. And so it was a great crop, but even their own production, let alone what they could donate to us, was reduced because of it. They just couldn't do as much because of the restrictions on the numbers of pickers that could be in the orchard at any one time. They just had to work around that. So, yeah, there were some other things that hopefully we'll have worked our way through this year when it gets time for harvest, and we're still counting the events. We're counting on the Pendleton Roundup and some other things to happen, and right now they're planning on having them, you know, and like everybody else, they're waiting to see how things go. But you know, it's been a little trying, and certainly I know that you're very aware of the demand that was placed on the Oregon Food Bank and the other food banks nationally, and certainly their network last year. And they met the demand. It's pretty amazing. There were lots of other sources of food, federal programs and things that, and other donations besides ours that came in, as well as a lot of cash to purchase food. And so, but the amount went up by about 50% probably from what they had done a year previously. So there was a big demand on food, so that didn't go away. And they were pretty much able to meet the demand. It was pretty amazing.
So you mentioned that there's some events. How does your work get supported outside of those farmers who donate a portion of their crops to you to get to Oregon Food Bank?
I'm glad you asked. It's we have a programs or a slogan called Adopt an Acre. And that's the third leg of the stool. We have the growers, processors who donate the food products. We partner with Oregon Food Bank for the handling and distribution. We rely on the public to support us through this Adopt an Acre program. And it's basically a way to donate. And we call it Adopt an Acre. We tie amounts to what might cover an acre's worth of certain crops, but really any amount is desirable. That's how we participate and partner with the public. And we encourage people. We have a website, of course, farmsendinghunger.com. They can look at our website and lots of ways to donate there, anywhere it says Adopt an Acre. And that's been a pretty major, you know, we get business support, business organizations, but lots of individuals also support us and is very encouraged. So you basically help get that theoretical acre of product from point A to point B and help us cover any associated processing costs. Because we do try to cover all those associated costs before it gets to Oregon Food Bank so that they don't have any additional cost involved with receiving the product from us.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with John Burt, the executive director of the nonprofit organization Farmers Ending Hunger. We're talking about how the organization works to end hunger in the state by linking donations from farmers to food processors and the Oregon Food Bank.
And since you're the executive director, to your mind, or from your perspective, why is there such a hunger problem in our state, and how are farmers related to that solution?
Well, I think, you know, we're talking on related to Earth Day, and certainly any to me personally, any sustainability model includes being able to feed people on a sustainable basis. That, to me, you can't have any kind of other food system model that's sustainable if there isn't enough food in the system to feed everybody. So that kind of thinking feeds into it. Well, why are so many people still accessing food banks? Prior to the COVID-19 last year, prior to that, the food banks actually saw, for the first time in a long time, actual reductions. You know, the recession of 2009 pushed it right back up, and we actually saw the numbers and the tons and the amounts all go down a little bit, 2017-18. First time people had seen that in decades probably. It always stayed the same or gone up a little bit. The recession pushed it up. So the history of it there is, well, why Oregon? Why is Oregon number one at that point? We're right in the middle of the pack now, maybe 10 or 15. We tend to run a little higher on childhood nutrition. But what I have heard from people from the Oregon Hunger Task Force, does research for the legislature, and the information Oregon State University has done, really looked into a lot of the data. Why Oregon? And the answers that I get are that the cost of housing related to income, the cost of other things like energy, fuel, energy, electricity, all that, so utilities compared to income, even though we have one of the higher minimum wages in the country, family income is not there compared to the cost of those things. And those are the factors that I see weighed in. There's certain parts of the demographics of who needs a food box that are kind of obvious. Single parents, usually more predominantly single mothers, single women parents. The cost of daycare, the cost of all these other things, housing, everything, compared to income, means that even though you may be on food stamps, get supplemental SNAP benefits, it doesn't quite make it to the end of the month. And that last week to get a food box to make it through is who we see. We don't see people all the time. You know, you're in a income category where things are tight, and you have a dental bill, or you have a car repair bill, or something happens, and you just can't make it that month. And so come come in that one time or two times to access the food bank to take advantage of that food. Because that's the last thing that people pay or spend money on when you're that tight, income is that tight. You got to pay the rent, you got to pay electricity, if you got a car payment, you got to pay these other things, or they'll cut you off or you get evicted, which is why we see the homeless situation. Food is discretionary, and so you can see that people go down to the last minute and the last thing they've got there is food, and then adults, parents will feed their children first, and then there's sometimes just not enough at the end of that month to do it. So that's where we're the safety net for many people, and there's a network of over 900, close to 1,000 pantries, agency members throughout the state of Oregon that actually deliver the food through meal sites. There are many meal sites in communities, but also through the various pantries that are there. There may be some other factors, but those are the ones that I've seen and heard over and attested to by folks that do this research and look into it.
Yeah, and then you mentioned also, you brought up briefly Earth Day, which is on Thursday, April 22nd, and, yes, you know, being that time of the year, addressing climate change is definitely on people's minds right now. Can you speak a little more to how your organization plays into that effort in the spirit of Earth Day?
Well, the growers are very keen on what's going on in climate change and availability of irrigation water. Many of these crops that we get are irrigated crops, potatoes, onions, not so much cherries, but some of them are. The vegetables certainly are irrigated, so the supply of water, the change in climate, the amount of rainfall, the temperature changes, those all affect agriculture, and they affect agriculture in other areas. You know, we're an international system in agriculture, and so things that affect other parts of the world will certainly affect us, and sometimes will affect the markets out there. So the growers that we work with are very much involved, and I was very encouraged that the United Nations adopted zero hunger as one of their sustainable goals for the future, and tied it to Earth Day. Because I think it's, like I said before, I don't think a system is sustainable if there isn't enough food for everybody. And there's many parts of the world where this doesn't happen, and it's not necessarily we can't produce enough, it's just that we can't get it to people and get it to people in a safe way. So the distribution, storage, handling, all that comes into play, and it's disturbing when you're involved in something like agriculture and to see that despite our best efforts, there's some people that still can't get enough food.
And when you are talking to new people about your organization, do you encounter misconceptions about what the impact of farmers ending hunger is?
Sometimes, yes. Growers ask, okay, where does this food I'm donating go? Who's getting it? And there are misconceptions that I think many people think that, well, it's totally people that are on the welfare rolls forever and they're not working and they're just looking for a handout. And as I described before, I think, and I didn't say the number, I think something like 60% of those getting a food box, somebody in the family's working, so it's more working poor. So yes, I do get those questions. Most of them get the idea. In fact, on camera sometimes we've asked growers, you know, doesn't this cost you take from the bottom line? Yes, it does. They say, well, then why are you doing it? And to a person, I have heard them say, because it's the right thing to do. They get feeding hungry people. And so once they understand that it comes back to your community, that there's a distribution model, we're working with Oregon Food Bank, reliable, very well known, reliable organization, that, and we have very little overhead in our as a nonprofit, that their product is going to go directly without too many moving parts, going to go directly to somebody that needs it in a food box. And once they understand that and some of the explanation about, well, why are so many people hungry, and what is the, why is there this problem? Farmers that I have talked to get it. They get the idea of feeding hungry people, and so, but there are some misconceptions, and they ask the right question. You know, who, where is this going, and who's going to get it? Is it all going to Portland? No, it's not all going to Portland. It gets distributed back out through the state, and we often have product that's left out in the regional food banks just because it doesn't make sense to send it to Portland and send it back. So,
John, do you have any final thoughts before we wrap up here?
Well, gosh, I'd encourage people, of course, the whole, as you know, the business of nonprofits is fundraise, fundraise, fundraise. I hate to say that, but it's what it is. We need help to continue to support the Oregon Food Bank and to continue to do what we do. So I'd encourage people to search out our, get to our website, farmersendinghunger.com. It's www.farmersendinghunger.com. And check us out. There's some farmer stories on there, and the need is still great. The issue, the COVID, obviously we know the economy hasn't recovered yet. The numbers haven't exactly tailed off or begin to decline very much. So the food bank, the demand of the food banks is still up. So now is as much as ever. We still need people's support and awareness of what's going on in the whole hunger issue.
I've been speaking with John Burt, the executive director of the nonprofit organization Farmers Ending Hunger. More information about the group can be found online at farmersendinghunger.com. For KBOO News In Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
So, welcome to COVID Noise Filter. My name is Dr. Mark Yandere, and we are so happy to have guest co-hosting with us, Nurse Julia. Welcome to the show, Nurse Julia.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited to be coming on board with you guys.
Thank you so much. And now on to the show. What our brains say about long-term effects of COVID-19? 8.4 million. That's the estimated number of people who've contracted coronavirus and may not be able to overcome the lasting physical effects of COVID-19. Researchers from the National Institutes of Health say that the brain is the key to figuring out those effects.
According to NBC News, researchers at the NIH have been diligently working on several projects to try and ascertain why some patients experience lingering symptoms weeks and even months after the acute infection. Symptoms can include profound fatigue, brain fog, shortness of breath, fevers, and headaches. The goal of the project is to figure out how the coronavirus affects brain tissue by studying the brains of those that unfortunately died from COVID-19.
Yeah, researchers had a sample of 30 brains from people aged 5 to 80. The samples were analyzed using MRI, and the team looked for active virus in the brain tissue, but surprisingly, there was no virus to be found. However, they did find a large amount of inflammation.
Yeah, they also found a protein called fibrinogen, which normally plays a role in blood clotting. However, fibrinogen should not normally be found in the brain. Its presence suggests that there were tiny blood clots in the brain that decreased oxygen levels. The decreased oxygen levels can lead to a lot of things, including brain fog and stroke. While the results of the brain research are significant, what they could mean are only theoretical at this point, and they may not be the only cause of the long-term COVID-19 symptoms.
Yeah, it's super fascinating. Other NIH research is looking at the nervous system changes of those who recovered from COVID-19, lung fluid samples, and imaging of the brain, heart, and lungs. Hopefully, science will prevail swiftly to help those suffering from the most physical effects of the coronavirus. Truly fascinating, Julia. Like, right? I mean, we know, well, one, let's just take a huge step back and say all of this stuff could have been prevented had we acted in a coordinated and central perspective. So I just want to be very clear about that, that our approach was terrible. But now we have folks that are having these microemboli or these clots in their brains, which could be responsible for a lot of the adverse effects that people are feeling after, or the lingering effects rather, that people are experiencing after having COVID.
Yeah, this is so interesting. I mean, I'm so shocked to hear fibrinogen.
Yeah, fibrinogen in the brain.
Yeah, I'm just curious to see what else they're going to find out, you know, in future research. I think all of this is still so very new. So that unexpected finding, I mean, I just can't imagine what else will come from the research. So we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, we'll continue to follow up on this story. An equitable distribution of the COVID-19 vaccine. Okay, so now, according to the New York Times, more than 800 million doses of the COVID-19 vaccine have been administered worldwide. Now, unfortunately, this is not an equitable distribution of the vaccine. Israel is one of the top countries, with about 58% of its population having received at least one dose of the vaccine and 46% receiving both. Other countries at the top include the United Kingdom, Chile, and the United States, with 38%, 28%, and 22% respectively of the population having received one dose. Now, this inequitable vaccine distribution is evident across continents as well. Now, while North America has administered 18 doses per 100 people, South America has only administered 4.9 doses per 100 people. Global health advocates have accused President Biden of vaccine hoarding. There needs to be improvements in the distribution of the vaccine, or the virus will continue to spread and evolve. These advocates want the administration to provide funding and supplies to more needy nations. To address this shortage in Southeast Asia, the United States will partner with Japan, India, and Australia to expand the global supply. Now, recently, the Biden administration has announced plans to send millions of doses of the AstraZeneca vaccine to Mexico and Canada, thereby getting us one step closer to a more equitable distribution. So this is super important and something that we'll continue to follow, but making sure that all of us are vaccinated at the same time, and by all of us, I mean the globe, is really the only way that we're going to be able to move forward to make sure we get through this pandemic, because the one thing that we don't want to do is leave some pockets of populations not vaccinated. And those are the individuals that could potentially create new variants. So we need to vaccinate all of us at once. And this seems like a decent plan to make sure that we move forward toward that goal.
What parents think of remote learning? A recent NPR poll revealed interesting insight into what parents think of remote learning for their kids. Children's education has been impacted by the effects of the pandemic. Some outcomes were favorable for some families, while unfavorable for others. This poll shed light on some of the details of parents' thoughts on virtual learning.
That's right. In fact, of the parents who were polled, about half of them have a child who's currently learning remotely. About 17% of the parents have a child who's in a hybrid environment with both remote and in-person learning. Now, the poll showed that there is broad support for bringing students back to in-person learning at some capacity. Now, roughly two-thirds of parents support going back to school once teachers receive vaccines. Now, another interesting finding was that the parents with children attending in person, 85% reported that the teachers and students wear masks and social distance at all or most of the time.
In reviewing how the quality of education has impacted the child, more parents feel their child is left behind when it comes to soft skills, such as communication, socialization, and mental health. 62% of parents reported that their child's education was disrupted, begging the need for greater support. 8 out of every 10 parents supported structured social, emotional, and mental health support for their kids, according to the poll.
More than 80% of parents support the implementation of targeted additional services to help children catch up.
Now, one striking finding was that 29% of parents say that they plan to stick with remote learning indefinitely. 29%. Wow, that is such a huge number. Though virtually all parents across the poll supported the idea of providing more support services and structure to better assist the children in navigating their educational journey. That's amazing. I would have never guessed that 29% of parents say that they want to stick to remote learning indefinitely.
I mean, it just reminds me of a recent TikTok that I saw, actually, that was talking about never going back into the office. I would beg to say that this big or huge percentage of parents in favor of remote learning for their children are also in favor of remote work for themselves as well. So that's
right
to consider.
Do you think that we could encourage some of these kids to have a TikTok about never going back to school again?
Absolutely.
And I actually know what TikTok is. This is what I was going to say. So. Which is impressive enough.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, even the parents are on there saying, hey, we're never going back.
That's great. Well, good. Well, again, as we say on COVID Noise Filter, we'll continue to follow with the story. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right. Portland.
Greetings, I'm Ansa Kriglin.
And I'm Winston Watson.
And I'm Donald Clark.
And we are The Meditation.
We are listening to Community Radio.
KBOO
90.7 FM, Portland, Oregon.
Yeah. Dig it.